listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. In 1950, 22% of American adults were single. Now that number is almost 50%. One in seven adults lives alone. Half of all Manhattan residences are one-person dwellings. I'll let Eric Kleinenberg astonish you with further facts, but clearly a lot of us like living alone, and that can mean a lot of things, from enjoying peanut butter right out of the jar, to staying in your pajamas till afternoon, or even cooking nude if you so desire. Some people talk to their cat, but even people who live with other people talk to their cat, so we'll find out what it all means soon. It's possible now to live alone and not be alone, to sustain thriving relationships of all kinds, to find an active social and romantic life without being coupled. It's a rich subject, one that touches many of our lives, and tonight we'll talk about it with Eric Kleinenberg, author of Going Solo, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone. Eric Kleinenberg is professor of sociology at NYU and editor of the journal Public Culture. His first book, Heatwave, A Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago, won many scholarly and literary prizes. His second book was Fighting for Air, The Battle to Control America's Media. He'll be in conversation with writer and cultural critic Lori Weiner, who's done the honors as interlocutor several times for Aloud. She's been a theater critic for the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and an editor at the Harper's Bazaar. In 1994, she was named chief drama critic at the LA Times and then left to do screenplays and feature pieces. She was West Coast editor for AARP magazine. And her next piece for More magazine will be on playing poker in Macau. How cool is that? She's a founding editor at Los Angeles Review of Books, which you should all check out. And please join me in welcoming Eric Kleinenberg and Lori Weiner. Thank you.
So nice to be in a room with a bunch of people. Doesn't feel lonely at all. This is the book. Now, I was going to start by giving you some of the statistics in the book. The subtitle is The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone. That kind of tells you a lot, I mean, more than most subtitles do, about the book. Maybe we should start by talking about the cover art, which is kind of interesting, because Eric was just telling me that the discussion about what the cover art should convey might let us understand the thoughts behind the book a little better. I don't know if you can all see the three birds sitting on three separate birdhouses, kind of looking at each other on their own houses. What was the conversation like to get the cover image right?
Well, so there were two challenges. We had to come up with the cover image, and we also had to come up with the title. And let me just say at the outset, this is a book that came out of many mistakes. I had a lot of stuff wrong when I started the project, and so there were kind of a whole series of corrections that got us to here. So when the project started, the title of the book was Alone in America. You know... Okay, all right, get it. So if you think about it, you know, that's a title that takes you to a really different place emotionally than going solo. And if the title's going to be Alone in America, then there are basically two options that you have that are just kind of low-hanging fruit. And the first is kind of like a Lone Ranger figure, mm-hmm. which makes sense because kind of until about the 1950s, living alone was most prevalent in the kind of big open western states like Alaska and Wyoming and Nevada, mm-hmm. and that wouldn't have been a terrible depiction. But so I live in New York City, and I'm guessing that you know the image that was ready to be on the cover of the book, at least the painter, right? It was Edward Hopper. It was Nighthawks from 1942, and it's the image is melancholy and lonely. It's an amazing painting because, you know, the main figure, actually his back is to you. He's sitting alone at the diner, at the counter, and you don't see his face, but you project onto him a whole bunch of sadness. He might be smiling for all we know, but you know, the painting allows us to do that. Then across from him is this couple, and they're dressed up, and they're close to each other, but they're not quite touching. Like, it's probably a date that didn't go very well. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that's a big idea, because it's the first hint that it's pretty lonely to be with the wrong person. Mm-hmm. And then the painting is really lonely because there's no door in the diner. Mm-hmm. These guys are trapped in there. So it's like the air is sucked out. And, okay, so this too was not what I was going for with the book. So two, you know, big things had to happen. The first is we needed to come up with a different language. And going solo really lands on what the book became about after I was able to learn a few things. And then the birds, it jumps a species. But it says you don't already know this story. You know, it challenges you to kind of think about what it is to go solo without Ed Hopper.
Yeah. And interesting, because in the Hopper painting, people are together in a room, but they're very lonely. Mm. And something that comes out of this book, which I find extremely heartening, is that the idea that you can be alone in a room and still feel very connected to many, many people, not just because of social media, but because of, you know, how we live our lives. Okay, so in the book, Eric starts, as all books should, with the Bible. He talks about...
All good books should, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. That when God created, took a day to create each thing, he would create something, and then he'd look at it, and he'd say, it is good. And that the first time he didn't say that was when he created Adam, because he looked at Adam, and he kind of turned into a Jewish mother, and he said, it's not good that he should be alone. And that was the first thing that God created that he didn't think was good, yeah, was being alone. So, and then, and Eric goes on to say that many species most species don't live alone. No species live alone, really. Even hermit crabs live with other hermit crabs. So
who knew, right?
That you had to be happy when you found that out. And then Louise hit on some of the statistics, but I'll just give you a couple more because they are so interesting and startling. Globally, 277 million people live alone. Today, the majority of all adults in America live alone or are single. 31 million people, one out of seven adults in America, I guess that is, live alone, the 31 million figure. More women than men, 17 million versus 14 million. Women do it better. That's another topic. the vast majority of people who live alone are between the ages of 35 and 64. They tend to cluster together in metropolitan areas, which is very different than what Eric was saying about living in, you know, Utah in the olden days. And also another really surprising thing is that the people who can afford not to live alone choose not to live alone. They choose not to live alone, which I think is really interesting and heartening. As I said, there's a lot of causes, but we can talk about. But one I wanted to bring up, because I'm a baby boomer, and Eric talks about Dr. Spock. Some of you may remember the most influential child-rearing expert in the 50s and 60s. And his big thing was the baby has to sleep by itself in the crib. It has to, no family bed. It has to get used to the idea that it is an individual alone in the world, that you have to have that knowledge to be able to function as a full adult in the world. How influential do you think that particularly was?
Dr. Spock?
For the to this, I
shouldn't
mean,
I be lying down for this conversation?
Absolutely.
No, okay, so you know, so I learned so much, including the history of the crib and the private room, and it's great that we got to start with God and then Dr. Spock, because those are big, you know, these are big figures. So it turns out that historically, the crib, which we take for granted as this necessary thing, this necessary technology for properly raising a healthy child, is a completely new invention. Historically, it's been common to have infants sleep in the family bed, close to the mother. And so, too, is the private room, the individual room. Mm-hmm. Unprecedented historically. And kind of, for instance, in 1950, the typical American home had more people than bedrooms. And, today the typical American home has more bedrooms than people, just slightly. Mm-hmm. But there's a shift there. So what Dr. Spock does is begins to kind of address American parents and then the parents all over the world, because this is a book that's translated into so many languages, and say, there is a right way to raise a person, and that is to individuate them from the beginning, to give them a separate place to sleep. And there's probably something wrong if you're not giving your child that. And then Dr. Ferber takes this to another level altogether and says, the child doesn't just need a separate place to sleep, the child needs a separate room. And if you can't, if there's something that makes you reluctant to give your child a place to sleep that's not in your room, mom and dad, that's probably a reflection of something that's wrong with you. And there's probably something that you need to work out personally. Mm-hmm. And this reflects a completely different idea about, how to raise a child.
Yes, it's interesting to think of time alone as a luxury, a gift, rather than a diminishment. And one of the things that Eric talks about in the book is that what's happening now across the world is giving a lot of people an opportunity to kind of find out more about the human condition, because living alone, it gives you time for reflection and time to study ourselves and really kind of, and there's a strain of American thought and philosophy going back to Emerson and Thoreau, which we'll get to in a minute, that really prizes this kind of knowledge, this kind of information, and it's a great luxury. Now, growing up in India or in most countries in Africa, maybe all countries in Africa and many places in the world, children never get to be alone ever. I mean, people are piled into rooms, and I assume that what they know about life is different than what we know about life. There's probably value in both camps, but...
I mean, so it seems kind of obvious today, now that many of us, cuddle up to our iPhones before we go to bed. but solitude is a kind of luxury. We live in a moment where kind of over-connection is the problem of our time, our kind of incapacity to be where we are. Okay, actually, this is my phone ringing. Can I come back in just a minute? I mean, this is a real issue that we deal with. And solitude gives us a chance to think about who we are, how we're living, how we'd like to live better, the kind of person we'd like to be. It gives us a chance to connect or maybe reconnect with ourselves. And it also, I think, paradoxically gives us a chance to reconnect with other people, to establish relationships that have depth and quality and meaning. So at this moment when we have thousands of friends who, friends, people we don't know, where kind of superficial contact is the order of the day, I think there's a role for solitude that we need to reconsider. And if you live alone, you have an access to that. That's really unusual. But this solitude I'm speaking of is necessary for everyone. It's not just for people who live alone. It's something that we need. So it reminds me that I probably should say at the outset, one of the things I tried to do in the beginning of the book is to make a very careful distinction between things that are often confused or conflated in our discussions about a theme like this. So living alone, for me, is very different than being alone. Living alone and being alone are very different things. And feeling lonely is another thing altogether. And there can be pathways that connect these. Mm-hmm. But you can be in a room by yourself and feel very connected, but you can also be in a room full of other people and be profoundly lonely. And I've kind of mentioned this before, but I could put it even more sharply. The people I interviewed who had been married, had lived with someone, and had now decided to live alone, said that not only was there nothing lonelier than being in the wrong marriage or living with the wrong person, but that when they were living alone and they felt lonely, that loneliness was a kind of cue for them to go out into the world and reconnect. Mm. Like physiologically, the experience of loneliness says to you, you know, there's something that you should do. But when you're married or in some kind of intimate relationship and you feel lonely or isolated, it's a more difficult emotion. It's a more difficult psychological state, and the cue is not so clear. You know, what are you to do with that? So I think that when we kind of get inside of these emotional states or these experiences like solitude, the way that we think about what it is to be alone or to be together really gets complicated. Mm.
And it's very surprising. The book it just makes you think about things a little bit differently and more deeply. These topics about being alone and being together. One of the things that Eric writes about that I found amusing. Well, he's talking about Emerson and Thoreau, and so these were the great American philosophers of self-reliance and who believed in the pleasures of isolation and. Now, Thoreau lived at Walden Pond for 2 years, his great exercise in seclusion and isolation. But as Eric points out, we're really talking about moderate isolation. He lived at Walden Pond for 2 years, but it took him about 25 minutes to walk into the city, which he did frequently. He had people come and visit him at Walden Pond, and his mother came and brought him meals. So the isolation is good to a point. I mean, even for Thoreau, too much is not so good. Also, another philosopher, not American, but one that had great insight into American nature, de Tocqueville, said that he saw us as a nation of joiners. And he also pointed out how the family can be very isolating, unit. I thought this was interesting because I had a very close family, and I do remember this feeling that other people weren't to be let in. The way that we stuck together, I found isolating, and I think that people can use the family unit to close off from the world.
So let's think of it in two different respects. First of all, there was what for me was the really startling fact, which I learned not through my interviews, which couldn't tell me this, but just by looking at the big social surveys about the way that people who live alone and people who are married conduct themselves in the world. So it turns out that people who live alone are more likely than people who are married to spend time with their friends, to spend time with their neighbors. Mm. It's not surprising to you to learn that they're more likely to go out at night and spend time in bars and restaurants and cafes, more likely to come to the public library for an event and go to public, but more likely to volunteer in civic organizations. Mm. And that, for me, was the real kind of shocker. Well, I had a lot to learn in this book. Mm. So it turns out that there's a colleague I have, a sociologist named Naomi Gerstel, who talks about the greedy marriage. And as a father of two young children, I don't feel greedy. But I appreciate what she's saying, because when you're married, your time and your energy goes into your home, which is what you're discussing. Single people have time and energy to participate in the public realm and do more than we conventionally acknowledge. There's this idea that single people and people who live alone are narcissists. That the selfish singles concept.
Some of them are.
But the idea is out there. The idea is out there. Some of them are, but so are some of the married people. It turns out that women are especially less likely to participate in this kind of public realm activities, to volunteer, if they're married. Mm-hmm. This was shocking to me, because it's not in any way true in my family. But it turns out that women do the majority of the domestic work.
Shocking.
A lot of I read it, and the data say that's true. So, I mean, it's not, it shouldn't be surprising to us, right? We know this. We know that women in a family do the majority of the domestic labor unrecognized, uncompensated, often unappreciated. We know that they put time and energy into the family, which is a certain kind of social labor, a certain kind of community work, for sure, which is why the trouble with the greedy concept. But that's not the, you know, it eats up time that might otherwise go into this kind of public realm activity. So families can be isolated in that sense. Then there's this other way, which is now becoming kind of almost already a kind of cliche of our time, which is the idea of the family kind of sitting around the dinner table, each person, you know, in their screen, right? Or in these big houses that we've been building, where, you know, the dinner ends, and then everyone kind of goes to their own place and gets their privacy. So you can actually be separate and isolated while at home.
Right, which is, you know, a good thing and a bad thing, depending on. But I was thinking about, you know, Sex and the City and how, I mean, I was married already when it came out, but it made me kind of nostalgic for my single life, and obviously made many, many people feel that way too. And I think that one of the interesting points that it made was that friendship is sweeter and richer sometimes when you're single, because it means more. And maybe, you know, we get married and maybe we give that up, some of that.
Let me take it here. There's a thing about Sex and the City that is worth mentioning, which is that the main characters are women. And there is an issue about living alone that I think deserves more attention than it gets, and that is that, you know, as you mentioned in the beginning, women tend to do it better than men. Women are more likely than men to live alone. It's about 32.7 million Americans who live alone, according to the last census, the estimate of 2011. About 18 million, a little more than 18 million are women. A little more than 14 million are men. So women are more likely to live alone. They're far less likely to be alone, to be isolated. Women do a better job in making and maintaining relationships with friends and also with family members. And I learned that kind of the hard way. The first book I wrote about the heat wave in Chicago was a book about people dying alone. Really, that was the troubling thing. Hundreds of people died. 700 people died in a couple days, and a huge number of them died alone. And it was surprising because women are much more likely to age alone than men, mm-hmm. for the reasons that we know. In fact, that is a big reason that there's so many more women who are living alone than men in general. They're just more likely to be alone, living alone, in the older years. Men are actually more likely to live alone under the age of 45, which we don't often hear. But women were far less likely than men to die in the heat wave in Chicago. So I knew that there was something going on about this. And then as we did research for this book, which there's more than 300 people who are interviewed in the book in different cities, from California to New York and a little bit in Europe as well, We found this, that the men really do face risks of getting isolated, and maybe the nostalgia for that kind of Sex and the City moment is not quite there in the same way.
Well, maybe one of the reasons you needed to do this book was because it was so depressing to do the research for the Chicago heat wave.
So let me own up to this. I mean, when the book started, it wasn't just that it was alone in America. It was that there was a health... an organization called the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which is a wonderful supporter of research on health, and they got very interested in the problem of social isolation. And I think with good reason. It's an issue that is part of the story of the book and one that deserves attention. Mm-hmm. There are people who live alone and get isolated, particularly people who are frail, sick,
poor.
Very elderly, poor. The people I got to know really well when I wrote the book about the heat wave. And there was a way in which, in kind of doing that project, you know, Alone in America, I was writing into this tradition, which we have in American intellectual culture, and it's a tradition with a message that goes something like this. Once upon a time, there was a golden age. Our relationships were stronger. Our communities were more cohesive. Our marriages worked. Our children played in the streets.
Are you running for president?
We felt less lonely. Those days are gone. We have fallen. We are isolated. We are alone. So the books that are the best-selling books in the history of American sociology have titles like this: The Lonely Crowd, The Fall of Public Man, The Pursuit of Loneliness. And then, like, the recent ones, does anyone remember Bowling Alone? Right, and there's, speaking of cover images, there's the kind of melancholy, you know, lonely roller, you know, holding the ball, his face down. America's communities have declined. Sherry Turkle, who's a wonderful psychologist at MIT, has a new book called, you know, Together Alone, or Alone Together. And the idea is, you know, we are in our screens and we're not with each other, which we can relate to in some way. My view, having really looked at this, because in many of these books, the person living alone is the symbol, is the signal and symbol of how atomized and individuated we've become. My view, what I came to appreciate, is when you look very closely at this, you start to see that we're actually much more socially engaged in the world than we think. There was a study in the Best American Sociology Journal that came out in 2006. It said 1 in 4 American adults have no confidant, no person with whom they can discuss confidential and important matters. One in 4 Americans has no close friends. It's a terrifying idea. And when the authors published it, this very academic, technical paper in a scholarly publication, they were invited onto every major talk show covered in the USA Today, in the New York Times. Books have been written about this phenomenon. You know, it's not just, we love this story. So it turns out that the data were wrong. And I write about this in the book, and the Chronicle of Higher Education went, and they called one of the guy who was the graduate student who co-wrote the paper, who did the data analysis, and he said, "Yeah, actually, they're so unreliable, you know, we don't trust the findings anymore." And let me tell you, that statement was not covered on the Today Show and the USA Today and the New York Times and these other places. We are more interesting than we think. Our social lives are more interesting than we think. We're about as social as we always have been. We're about as lonely as we always have been. And I think that you know, one thing I came to do in the process of working on this is to appreciate our intelligence, our social intelligence, and our creativity. I came to see the rise of living alone not as a social problem, though there are problems that come up, but as a social experiment, because we have about 200,000 years of history as a species living together in groups, and we have about 50 or 60 years of experience living alone. I mean, literally, until the 1950s and 60s, you cannot find a single society in all of human history that has large numbers of people living alone for sustained periods of time. Now it is ubiquitous. And I came to see how incredibly we had adapted.
Yeah, it's interesting because we are also just naturally alarmists. And anytime there's a change, we always, or the sociologists often...
Hey, watch it.
Okay, well, one sociologist that you quote in your book is Emil Durkheim, who's considered maybe the father of sociology, possibly. And, you know, this is early 20th, late 19th century. Okay.
Impressive.
He died in 1917. And his most famous work was about suicide. It was really the first kind of serious academic look at the causes of suicide. And he found that it was because religion was breaking up, and religion was the foundation of social life. And every sociologist after him has read the data in a similar way. We're about to embark on just a terrible, terrible period because it's fear of modernity. It's whatever's new is scary, and so whatever is old was better. And there's been tons of books about this new technology and how it isolates us, and it isolates children And one of the interesting things in Eric's book is that he has found that social media has made people who were social more social, and people who were isolated, arguably, possibly, more isolated. But that people who are social use social media to be more social.
Yeah. So this is a really interesting thing that, you know, and it relates to that Sherry Turkle kind of idea that our screens are pulling us away from each other, which they no doubt do in some respects. I'm not glib about this. But the heaviest users of the internet and social media, according to the best research we have, which comes from the Pew Internet study done by a guy named Keith Hampton, tells us that the heavy users are actually more likely to go out and spend time face-to-face with friends, face-to-face with neighbors. They go out into public. They have interactions with strangers. So some of our ideas are overblown. Our concerns are overblown. I have to say one thing about Durkheim, not that I was expecting to get there tonight, but he's actually an inspiration for me for one idea that's a slightly different kind of idea than the one that you mentioned. And that is that what he understood 100-plus years ago is that our modern independence, our autonomy as individuals, was made possible by our modern interdependence. Our independence is made possible by our interdependence, and it's by collectively investing in the common good, supporting each other, being socially integrated, that we gain the capacity to be alone, that we gain the security to be alone. And that proved to be kind of a real resource for me when I tried to puzzle out something else. You know, I've emphasized how I overestimated the isolation of people who lived alone or the loneliness of people who lived alone. But the other thing I did at the outset of this book is to overestimate the Americanness of this phenomenon, right? It wasn't just alone. It was alone in America. And it turns out that as staggering as these numbers are about, you know, how many Americans live alone, 28% of all households compared to 9% in 1950, that we have become laggards internationally when it comes to living alone. The countries that have the highest rates of living alone on Earth, Sweden, Finland, Denmark, Norway, right? The Scandinavian countries, where it's more than 40% of households are one-person households at the national level, not at the urban level. In Stockholm, it's more than 60% of households are one-person households. And it's because by collectively investing in the well-being of each other through subsidized housing and guaranteed health care and a guaranteed income and safe, secure streets that make people feel like they can go out, that the Scandinavian nations allow people to have the freedom to live the way they want to live, which is not isolated, but it's sometimes alone. And other countries that have higher levels of living alone than the United States, and there are many, France, Germany, England, family-centric Japan, higher levels of living alone than the United States. And, in recent years, the places that have had the fastest increases in living alone include China and India and Brazil. So there's not really a clear, you know, cultural driver for this outside of some respect for individual liberties. For instance, almost no one lives alone in Saudi Arabia, even though there's a lot of wealth. And that's an issue about women and also an issue about kind of cultural liberties. But this is not an American phenomenon. This is a story about human security.
In the countries that are lucky enough to be able to...
In the places where you can get human security. So living alone, and you mentioned this before, living alone is a fantasy of people who live in the most impoverished places on Earth. Mm-hmm. You can't dream of it. Mm-hmm. Living alone is very uncommon in impoverished American neighborhoods. To understand the experience of living alone and being poor, I had to go into like the kind of the Bowery District of New York City, the single room occupancy hotel residences, which are kind of the ones that remain because we've really decimated that supply of housing for poor people. Otherwise, it's just impossibly expensive. And so there's another thing I need to say at this point, which is that I don't think that you can understand the rise of living alone without using the language of choice. And this is essentially blasphemous for a sociologist, because in the intellectual division of labor in the modern world, the economists get choice and the sociologists get constraint. Like, we do constraint, they do choice. It's a bad deal. And I want to say this because this is a loaded topic. We don't get to choose the choices we have to choose from. So constraint. There is constraint, and the people we interviewed. There are some people we interviewed who said, "I'm happy being alone. I want to live alone. I really don't think I'll ever live with someone else." There are people who are like this, and they turn out to do really well on happiness, measures, because they adapt. They create their social lives in other ways. The majority of people who live alone have lived with someone else and say that, in the abstract, they would like to find the right person to live with. But what's really different about today from other moments in history is that people are not willing to settle for the wrong person. And women in particular have the economic independence in many cases, not always, but more than ever before, to live alone, and to be socially connected, and to not have to be in a relationship.
Not like in Downton Abbey.
Not like in Downton Abbey, right. That's right. So why do I say choice then? Because oftentimes people will say like, oh, well, I wish I had the right partner. Okay. But even then, there are other ways to live than alone. Craigslist offers a world of roommates who are ready to pounce on you. The moment you go online, you can live with friends, you can live with family members, your children or your parents. And here's the thing, 60 years ago, and certainly 100 years ago, that's what we did. That's what we did. Now we have clear preferences to live alone over those other options. Young adults live alone when they can afford to. It's a sign of distinction and success. They love living with their roommates until they don't. Older people who generally, this generation have been married, women tend to outlive their spouse. They said in our interviews over and over again they miss their spouse. They, it was a terrible loss. They wish they were still together. But now that they have kind of become single, they're surprised at the extent to which they feel fulfilled by their lives, surprised by the extent to which they feel satisfied. And the last thing in the world they want to do is move in with their children.
I love that part of the book. We don't have time. I was going to read a part where this woman was saying, she doesn't want to move in with her kids because she knows they're just going to use her for childcare, and they're annoying, and she doesn't trust them.
She's a strong case of this,
Yeah.
But the other thing, women who've taken care of their families, oftentimes cared for a husband who gets sick, oftentimes, seen him through to his final days, and said, I could see being in another relationship, I could see having romance, I could see having intimacy, I can't see marrying another guy. I'm not going to put myself in a situation in which I'm doing that again. There's someone in the front I just heard says, that's us. And it is. And when your book comes out and someone says, that's us, you feel much better about it because, there are some people who say, you should only study yourself. What are you doing writing a book about people who live alone? Because, what do you know? But that would be a terrible thing if you could only write about yourself. This is a kind of a powerful idea. And again, not to be glib about it. We shouldn't say that there are no issues. There's not loneliness. There's not pain. But there's loneliness and pain in life.
This is the time when I'm supposed to open the questions up to the audience, but I'm not ready to. I still have I have a lot of questions. I have just one more I want to ask you since it's a presidential primary.
We are occupying
primary
the stage
day.
Here.
Yeah. And then I'll open it up. I do want to talk about the public policy implications of what we're talking about. You know, there's a program, Meals on Wheels, in every state, maybe, I don't know, in the country, where obviously meals, hot meals are delivered to people who are living alone. And a huge part of why that program is important is not just for the meals, but for the human companionship, for the, you know, just spending an hour with someone who lives all alone is hugely important to that person who lives alone. Now, these programs are being cut, you know, every day, everywhere across the country. And it just seems like as you're identifying the new wave and the issues that come up with it, that is exactly when we are cutting, you know, any kind of public spending everywhere in every state across the country. And I was also thinking about Rick Santorum and the family values thing. And I was thinking family values can be an excuse for not spending any government money on anyone because families are supposed to take care of each other so the government doesn't have to. And if you're not in a family, there's something wrong with you. No one who you have to have a family to run for president. I mean, yeah. You have to. Anyway, I'm not sure that there's a question there, but. But
amen, is that you want an amen?
Well, I mean, it the very things that you're calling for in the book, which is to do things in the way that Sweden and Norway and Finland and Denmark do, you know, is exactly what we're not doing and we're really moving away from.
Right. So, you know, you could accuse me of being naive about many things. And I don't say at the end of the book that it's time for us to develop a Scandinavian socialist welfare state. Probably not the moment for that message. But whatever we think about that idea. But the end of the book is about redesigning solo life. And it starts with this question of, you know, what if we kind of stopped, we gave up on the fantasy that some moral leadership would persuade us all to stop living alone and just connect with each other. What if we gave up on the fantasy that if we just want to reach out and take people into our homes and we share things together that we will get out of this problem, which is kind of a fantasy of the Santorums of the world. What if we, instead of doing that, we started to spend some time and energy on kind of problem solving, how to make living alone a more connected experience for people who struggle with that, the people who age alone and get isolated. Other parts of the world have invested more resources into building forms of housing and kind of urban structures that provide people with the capacity to maintain their domestic autonomy, which becomes a part of their experience of dignity and integrity, while also getting better proximity to, you know, friendship, you know, companionship, services, care at home. You can't simply design it, but our cities are not designed to do that very well. Today, if you're pretty affluent and you are older and alone and you need some support, you could probably get yourself into an assisted living facility where you have your own place, but you have services around you, food and entertainment and programs and things like that. My grandmother, who died in the course of the research I did for this book, had Parkinson's, and she outlived two husbands. And at some point, she could no longer take care of herself. And she lived here. She lived in Southern California. My family was in Chicago. She moved back to Chicago. But that was a hard thing. And she was lucky enough to have three pretty successful children. And they pooled their resources, and they moved her into an assisted living facility. And you think at a moment like this, and maybe some of you can relate to this experience personally or someone in your family or friendship network, you think, it's my mother or it's my grandmother. And how could you not do anything but the best for this person? So you look at the assisted living facilities, and the one that's really great, where she's going to be happy, is really expensive. In this case, I think it was about $80,000 a year, which is a staggering amount of money. And you think, well, it's the end of life, so you do it. Mm-hmm. And then it turns out that we are really good at keeping ourselves alive. So it's kind of funny. Except for then, you know, you read Elizabeth Warren, now the running for Senate. Maybe, you know, one of our few national heroes, but once upon a time, not long ago, a scholar who wrote about how families get into debt. You know how American families get into debt? They get sick. Someone gets sick. Someone gets old and needs to be cared for. And very comfortable families who feel like we're on top of things, we've taken care of our finances, it's gone. And it goes like that. And it seems to me that as the boomer generation begins to age and more people experience kind of living alone and the challenge of, you know, maintaining financial security while aging alone in a country that doesn't provide an adequate amount of kind of public services for this, that doesn't invest in real solutions to this particular situation, that unless we do something when the economy turns around, you know, when we have resources to spend, unless we think about how to redesign buildings and neighborhoods and really tackle this problem, then we've got a serious situation. And so I think it's inevitable. And it's not that hard. They're actually good models, and I write about them in the book. You know, they're models in New York City. I'm sure they're models, you know, around Los Angeles. They're models around the world. We lack the political will. And so I feel like I need to say this. One reason I think that it's been hard to generate the political will around these issues is that we sometimes think this is something that matters for people who live alone. So I do radio talk shows now a lot. And the radio talk show hosts, who are brilliant people, often say, "Nan, if you live alone, call in. We'd like to hear your experience." To which I say, you know, this is not just a story for people who live alone. First of all, this is something that touches us personally or through the people in our lives. But also, you know, no matter who we are, no matter how we live today, you know, whether we live with someone or we live on our own, we probably can't say for certain how we will be living 3 or 5 or 10 or 20 or 50 years from now. And if we wait until this is the thing that matters for us because we're in trouble, then it will be too late.
On that cheery note, we will take questions from anyone who has one. There's a microphone over there.
Thank you for the talk. It's really, really interesting. But my question is, when you speak about the difference between the 14 and the 18 million, how much of that is demographical versus by choice? In other words, are there more women aging and that's why the numbers are higher, or is that truly a choice issue?
Well, so it's the driver for the gender difference is aging primarily, though not exclusively. There are issues about, you know, the way people get married and the fact that men are much more likely to marry younger women than women are to marry younger men. Though that's changing a little bit. But remember what I said about choice. So there are a lot of older women. I feel like this is slipping here. Sorry. Is it off now? Can you hear it? There are a lot of women who are who've aged alone, who've lost a spouse, who are still choosing to live alone over other available choices, like living with roommates or living with family. These are choices that would have been their choices not long ago. And the fact that they are saying, not only do I want to live alone, but my sense of integrity rests on it. If I can no longer live alone, that will feel like a kind of a profound loss of self. It'll be a loss of face. And not only do I want to live alone, but I will pay a premium to live alone. Right? That's the thing about all this. It's expensive to live alone. Right? So we know that people are opting into it in some way. That's how I think of choice.
I was wondering if there were any more assumptions or presumptions you made when you started out writing the book or preparing to write it that kind of got turned on their head, and also any other true epiphanies that came up along the way.
I feel like I'm kind of owning up to all sorts of stuff I got wrong. And it's like, don't bleed me dry here. So I thought it was less social, and it's more social. I thought there would be more isolation, and there wasn't. I thought it was an American story, and it wasn't an American story. It's a good thing that I had a chance to recover this. So I don't know. I feel like I've said a lot. I thought, and I still am amazed by this, I really thought that maybe this is this kind of coastal phenomenon. Like, we'd find a lot of living alone in San Francisco and Los Angeles and Seattle and Manhattan. I did not know that cities where more than 40% of households are one-person households include Atlanta, Minneapolis, Denver, Cleveland. You know, that it's really not this kind of thing that we is missing in the flyover, I say as a proud Midwesterner. It's a thing. It's in the world. So I will say this about, I won't give you more things that I was wrong about because I'm red-faced enough. But I will tell you, you probably get a sense for this, how kind of thrilled I am to have been so wrong and been able to recognize it. And I feel like, you know, this is a moment where too often our kind of public thinkers are actually leading with the conclusion. You know, they start with an argument, and then they search out the facts that will, you know, support it. And if they can't find them, they'll make their own facts that do. And that's a terrible way to live, and it's a terrible way to think. And one of the real virtues about being a professor or a writer and not a columnist on the op-ed pages of the Wall Street Journal or a candidate for office is that you can really think and look at what you learn and recognize when you get something wrong and change the story. So of all the projects that I've done, this is the one I've learned from the most.
You should have this conversation with Roger Ailes, I feel.
Hi, Eric. Great to be here. Could you talk a little bit about what you discovered or found in terms of the negative stereotypes against single people and the cultural bias that we seem to have that just seems to never go away, that one can never be truly socially successful unless we're married?
Yeah. And this, by the way, is Kim Calvert, who's the founder of Singular City, and this terrific magazine and now online resource that connects people and organizes events and is sponsoring the reception, which I hope you will all come to afterwards so that we can celebrate together. So let me start here. In 1957, a group of psychologists from the University of Michigan did a survey of a nationally representative sample of Americans, and they wanted to know about people's attitudes towards single and married Americans. And they discovered that 80% of Americans, 80% of people in the National Representative Survey, believed that adults who wanted to be single were either sick, neurotic, or my favorite, immoral. Those are three big words, big ideas, and 80% is a big number. So today, in a world where it's about half of American adults are single, and a third of them live alone, a social scientist couldn't even ask that question with a straight face, you know, let alone get an answer. So we've come somewhere. That said, we haven't made it all the way. We are excruciatingly judgmental in many ways, and some stereotypes and kind of stigmas continue. The people who really, I think, are suffering the most with the stigma who experienced it as a profound kind of personal problem, in my view, are young adult women kind of between the ages of, say, 35 and early 40s, who are dealing with questions about their biological clock, and they're dealing with issues about having children and whether they're going to get married. And I say that they experience this in a profound way because they are the ones who continually said to us in the interviews that people would project their anxieties onto them, that they reached a certain point. To have your own place as a young woman is to be successful, right? To have made it, to be able to afford it, to gain a level of autonomy that was historically unprecedented. And it's an amazing thing, actually. Single women have been the fastest rising segment of the real estate market, for the last decade or so, just until the recession. And single women are buying houses more than single men, even though they make less on average than single men, because it's not just an economic thing; it's a symbolic thing. It's a symbol to themselves and to the others that they are going to have their lives, and they're not waiting for the right partner to do it. I think that's a very big thing. So younger women tend to get a lot of support until suddenly the fact that they might not have biological children with a spouse, they might not even get married in the time when we used to expect people would get married, becomes a problem for people around them. It becomes a problem for their parents. It becomes a problem for their relatives. It becomes a problem for many of their friends. It becomes a problem for their colleagues. And they experience that suddenly they have this stigma that people project this onto them. And it's the first kind of moment in which they feel like they've lost some capacity to be who they are and to be recognized as who they are. They're not the only ones, and let me just be clear about this, that what they experience is something that's about the other people, not about themselves. Right? They became the objects for other people's anxieties, speaking of neurotic. They don't have that exclusively, and we still have an idea that permeates certain parts of society, that people who are single and unattached, who live alone, live that way because there's something wrong with them, because there's some lack, there's something missing in their lives. It seems to me like what we know about the social lives of people who live alone tells us that maybe they miss some things, but those of us who are married miss some things too. There's a lot potentially to experience. And there's not much stigma on the things that you miss when you're married. We don't worry much about the things you miss when you're married. So what I really tried to do here is, and I want to be clear, this is not a book in which this is not the case against marriage, this is not the case for marriage. I am not urging you to go home and leave your spouse. Honey, I heard this great talk at the Los Angeles Public Library today.
And we have to talk.
That's right. It's really not that. It's to say, we can be so terribly judgmental and severe with each other. And we are learning, I think, in some areas of our social lives to recognize and respect the choices that people make about how to live. Wouldn't it be nice if we extended that to this area, too?
Two more questions.
Yeah.
I have two questions. One is, in foreign countries, is the age demographic different than in America for people who are living alone? And when will we get to the point where we can be kinder to our parents than we can be to our pets? Why do we have to keep old people alive long beyond the point where they should be?
So I think the second question takes us to a place where we probably shouldn't go. And the first, it depends. So for instance, in the Scandinavian countries, for instance, it's much easier for young people. Young people are even more likely to live alone. It's really seen as a rite of passage in many Scandinavian countries to get a place of your own. And it was the kind of public support for a housing program that created an affordable housing stock for young people that made it possible for them to do this. But in Japan, you know, aging alone has really been the thing that's on the rise. So it depends. Yeah.
Hi. Thank you for a great talk. So I come from Pakistan, where the joint family system is still very much a reality. So even the kids, even when they grow up, they still prefer living with the parents for whatever reasons. But the question that I have is that the data that you have for America, does it have like a distinction depending on the ethnicities? Like if you, depending on where your parents are from or what your ethnicity is, does it make a difference in your choices?
Yeah, I have a certain amount of ethnic data, but not maybe at the level that you're looking for. Whites are most likely to live alone, followed by African Americans. Latinos and Asian Americans are less likely to live alone, but it turns out that the more the kind of community has been in the United States, and the more kind of the more they've kind of integrated into the economy and culture, the more prevalent living alone becomes too. And I think even the kind of global profile of living alone, where you start to see it emerge in countries that have emerging developing economies, tells us that some of those kind of traditional cultural, you know, values and preferences turn out not to matter as much as we think. The thing that really matters, and I feel like we kind of didn't hit it hard enough, you know, tonight, so I just want to say it one more time, but respect for women's autonomy and women's capacity to get an education and achieve some level of economic independence. And in cultural groups and in cities and in nations where women have opportunity in the cultural realm and also in the economic realm, living alone becomes much more prevalent. And I think that, you know, you've probably tracked over the last, you know, year or so, the sensational debates around things like the Hannah Rosen article in the Atlantic Monthly on the end of men and the Kate Bullock, you know, cover story on all the single ladies. And then even a couple years ago, there was this journalist, Lori Gottlieb, who wrote the opposite kind of book, article in The Atlantic. It was, you know, Marry Him, The Case for Settling. You know, saying, right. I don't think a lot of people followed that advice. But for me, what it represents is this kind of puzzling over how to live now. You know, that something new has happened. People, you know, we are creating a new way of living. This is the thing that's so remarkable to me, that we live at this incredible moment where we are kind of pioneering a way of organizing our personal lives, our family lives, a way of settling that we have never done before as a species. There are not a lot of things like that, it turns out. And it's very confusing. And it's especially confusing, I think, for women who are trying to think about having children and family issues. But the truth is that it's confusing for all of us. And it can create enormous amounts of pressure on us as individuals to sort through what it is that we want. So, you know, I'm not here tonight to tell you, you know, don't worry. Everything is fine. But I am here to say we might be worrying about the wrong things, and we could sharpen the questions that we ask of ourselves, and we surely could sharpen the way that we understand ourselves. And so what I hope, you know, this conversation has sparked, and what I hope the book does, kind of finally, is give us, you know, another language, another set of concepts. It's not alone in America, not bowling alone, but going solo. And maybe another kind of set of images, so that it's not, you know, Ed Hopper and isolation and melancholy souls in the diner,
but
it's the human version of the birds, right? So like the challenge for the paperback is to put people on there and for us, and for you to understand what it means. So thank you very much.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.